American media is a business, and it has a mission. Not to inform Americans, but to entertain them.
You know, there's happy news for happy people with happy problems.
And the business leaders said that they had to renew with vigor what they called the everlasting battle for the minds of men and indoctrinate citizens with a capitalist story.
Global corporations feeding us the news as they see fit.
Truth is subversive. It's anti-American.
Americans have computers in school, dozens of TV stations, and the most aggressive news media on Earth. Does that mean they're better informed? Hardly.
And it is a good day. This is Ryan Robson reporting to you from the internet for Monday, August 22nd, 2011. And you are listening to Newsreel, the WOG Global sit-rep on corporate legal tyranny, technology, and trends for your headspace and timing. Rant Media has taken a stand for free speech today, and just by listening and distributing this program, you are too. Also standing up for free speech and joining me today is Misanthropic Gods.
You can follow all these news stories and check our facts by going to the Rant Media forums and looking under Newsreel for a post with today's date. You get there by going to smf.rantradio.com, and this would be a free podcast. It can be heard on Rant Radio Talk, Galaxy 15 Radio, and recorded live in Second Life every Thursday night at 7 p.m. SL time at Grid Archers 155-74666. What we need right now most of all is your support. If you have something to send us, please email us at news@rostudios.org. That is news@rostudios.org. Joining us live in Second Life today is Roshan Amaratsu, Morb Skytower, Anastasia Jennings, and Legion Rosenman.
So we got no feedback for this week, so I'm just going to jump straight into the news. We have a bit of a Persec alert here, which is recovering website passwords from a stolen laptop, thanks to Destined. Now, of course, you already know about this, but there's some more details here. Lose your laptop, change all passwords pronto. If your Windows laptop is stolen, be warned. New research shows how a thief can gain access to passwords used by your various website names here. The passwords for accounts in the cloud are supposed to be protected by the Windows built-in encryption. But a team of security researchers demonstrated at the Black Hat Security Conference last week how to bypass the operating system security. A thief or someone unconcerned with the finer points of federal hacking laws can take advantage of the vulnerability to discover the passwords stored by web browsers and other programs like instant messaging clients. So can police, using electronic forensics, to analyze a computer seized during a criminal investigation or without a warrant at a national border. It is not just your data on the computer, but everything you have in the cloud, including your Facebook account, your Gmail account, and so on. Ellie Burstein, postdoctoral researcher at the Stanford University, who also analyzed Microsoft's geolocation database, told CNET, Ivan Fontarensky, Matthew Martin, and John Michael Picard collaborated with him on the research. The team has released an open source utility to perform this decryption, which they call OWAID for Offline Windows Analyzer and Data Extractor. It runs on Ubuntu, Debian-derived Linux distribution, and is designed to decrypt information stored by the four major web browsers and instant messaging clients under Windows XP. Here's how it works. Windows offers a built-in encryption feature called DPAPI, part of the Crypto API, which allows application developers to store sensitive data in a scrambled form. Microsoft describes as allowing any application to secure data without needing any specific cryptographic code other than the necessary function calls the DPAPI. API stands for Application Programming Interface. That's a useful feature to have, assuming it is designed and implemented well. What Burstein and his colleagues found are security vulnerabilities in the way DPAPI was created. For instance, the list of possible passwords in many versions of Windows is unusually small, about 7 trillion possibilities, and can be pre-computed. A Microsoft representative said the company would have a public response later today. Another vulnerability they found is in the way that passwords for Wi-Fi networks are encrypted and stored. In Windows XP, they're stored in a system registry. In Windows 7 and Vista, they're stored in both the registry and an XML file. Different browsers, they found, store passwords for different websites in different locations with varying amounts of security precautions. I'm very sad to say that Firefox is the worst for offline security, said Burstein, who uses the browser himself. Internet Explorer turns out to be most secure. If you don't know the exact web page, you can't recover the password. I kind of wonder how that works, where Internet Explorer is the most secure, but there you go.
You know, I'm really kind of surprised that Internet Explorer is the most secure here. I mean, they're you know, historically the one with the least security. But, you know, that's kind of how it goes. But this, you know, again, this is why if you're crossing an international border or anything like that, especially, you know, coming into the United States or leaving the United States, you should, you know, wipe your hard drive and not carry that data with you. If you have some place to upload it securely online, you know, such as an FTP server, and you can access it after you cross it back over the border, then that would probably be your best bet. You know, as you said, is you do a total wipe on your hard drive before you go over. And, you know, you just have a fresh install, you know, you throw some things on there that you want to have on there for a while, you know, if you're traveling or anything, you know, music, movies, stuff like that. And then whenever you get back over across the border, you can access your FTP and you can download anything that you want, you know, private pictures, any types of communications or anything like that. And that's pretty much what you want to do. You know, again, you know, you want to watch what you're putting out there. And if they have access to your information, you know, you should kind of be thinking about what you want them to know and what you don't want them to know and stuff that could possibly get you in trouble.
I personally make it a habit to not save any of my passwords on my laptop, specifically because of this, or any other portable device. But there are ways you can protect yourself from this. It looks like this is only affecting the encryption that is put on the registry end where the passwords are saved, and not the whole disk. So if you use full disk encryption through something like, I think the Windows version is called BitLocker, and stuff like that, then you can keep people from getting into the account to begin with, and it's much harder. They have to you know, break your password or break the encryption on your account and then get in. As someone said in here, TrueCrypt, but I don't know if you can actually boot off of a TrueCrypt volume. So if you put a little more encryption on there, oh, apparently you can, and he does. So Morps apparently does boot off a TrueCrypt volume, so don't worry about that too much. If you can figure out how to boot off TrueCrypt volume, do that, because TrueCrypt hasn't been cracked yet, and not that I'm aware of.
If you are running TrueCrypt, be aware that you can be forced into revealing your TrueCrypt password with threat of detention. So just so you know, it's better just to not have the data on there at all. And to them, any type of encryption on your machine is suspicious. So really, you know, it's kind of you know, a red flag to them. It's better just to have, you know, a fresh, clean install. Or as Pseudocrow said, laptop without a hard drive with a live CD plus access to the home server. You could also do that as well.
Well, the thing is, you're going to be forced to reveal a password if it's law enforcement that's going after you. We're talking more about your laptop being stolen here and some scam artists trying to get into your stuff. If the police want into your stuff, all you got to do is get a subpoena and they can get any records they want, so I'm not too worried about that. But on to Internet...
I'm just saying, as kind of a good course of action, you know, especially if you're crossing the border, because, you know, the border, everything on the border is crazy. That's kind of what I'm talking about.
Oh, yeah. Don't take anything across the border you don't want them to find. In Internet Lockdown News, thanks to Psychos for this one. British PM suggests quelling riots by disconnecting social media. And you've all heard about the BlackBerry thing, but this is a little bit beyond that. In a move that calls to mind the start of the most serious unrest in nations across the Middle East over the last year, David Cameron, Britain's Prime Minister, told Parliament Thursday that authorities may shut down social media websites like Facebook and Twitter in hopes it would return calm to their streets, because that worked so well in Egypt. The remarks came one day after British authorities discussed turning off the messaging functions on BlackBerry phones, which they suggested may remove a tool for protesters that protesters and rioters were using. Everyone watching these horrific actions will be struck by how well they were organized via social media, Cameron told Parliament. Free flow of information can be used for good, but it can also be used for ill. So we are working with the police, the intelligence services, and the industry to look at whether it would be right to stop people from communicating via these websites and services when we know they are plotting violence, disorder, and criminality. I also have asked the police if they need any other new powers. Cameron added that he considered sending British military in to quell the rioting, and that he provided police with additional powers such as the ability to order youths to uncover their faces. This order is likely tied to the widespread use of facial recognition technology, which has been employed by police to identify rioters. We need to show the world, which has looked on frankly appalled, that the perpetrators of this violence we have seen on the streets are not in any way representative of our country, nor of our young people, he said. Britain is still reeling after four of the worst nights of rioting for decades, which started in London and then spread to other cities including Manchester and Birmingham after police allegedly killed a young man named Mark Duggan, father of four, who they claimed was involved during a drug deal. Across the Middle East, brutal authoritarian regimes took similar action against communications in the face of unprecedented unrest, blocking Facebook, Twitter, and in many cases, cutting off internet and mobile phone access altogether. But each successive step only made the regime's problems worse. A number of Britons have already been arrested, allegedly for trying to incite riots via Facebook. Social media has also been used by Britons who sought to clean up after the rioters, and still others have begun using it to help identify offenders. Whether the British government would cut off access to their services entirely, or just for individual users, was not clear, but it is unlikely that they would block individuals identified among the rioters, as the technology and sheer complexity of such a task would compound as the project goes on.
This is, again, like we were saying in the last show, you can't stop people from communicating. People will find ways to communicate with each other, you know, via secondary means of communication. Hell, if they have to use frickin' messenger pigeons, they will, you know? You can't stop people from talking to each other. And this is really just more authoritarian lockdown of communications. But, you know, especially, and this is targeting the youth who use, you know, who are a lot more turned on to social media than a lot of the, you know, older generations and stuff like that. And frankly, you know, how I feel about the riots in Britain is frankly irrelevant, even though I do, you know, feel that it was absolutely ridiculous and that, you know, after the first night, people were there, just there to burn shit. So I kind of feel that, you know, if you do end up using social media and you end up, you know, posting pictures of yourself, you know, doing illegal activities, then, you know, I mean, you're playing with fire there. And you have to remember that if you're posting shit up online, that, you know, everybody has access to it, regardless if it's quote-unquote locked down or not, you know, regardless if you have any type of security on it. If it's up there, somebody can have access to it. It's getting out there. So if you're going to be doing anything like this, you know, don't take pictures of yourself doing it, you know. And again, look into stuff like the face paint to hinder the facial recognition technology, the white and black face paint to render that essentially useless, you know. And just, if you act smart, you know, don't do stupid things. If you are going to be rioting, don't act like a retard. And rioting is frankly kind of retarded to begin with. So, but I think that cutting off communications, either widespread or even, you know, select, you know, pinpoint strikes against people using social media, people are always going to find some way around it. So that all that you're doing is just, you know, creating more waste of taxpayer money.
Well, what they're not doing here is they're not paying attention to the way social media has worked with previous riots. With the Vancouver riots, the police didn't try to shut down social media at all. They didn't even think about it. They instead turned around and went, okay, we're going to use this, and we're going to try to identify as many of these people as possible so we can go after them. And in Egypt, where they actually did go and shut down all the web, they shut down the internet, basically, it actually caused everything to get worse, because there was civil unrest before, but the riots didn't break out until they shut down the internet over there. So they're not seeing the effects that these actions have had in recent times, these exact things. If they shut down social media, it's not going to stop the rioting. It might make it a little more disorganized. It's not going to stop it. In fact, it might actually get more people rioting, just because of the fact now you've shut down all the networking, so people are going to be pissed off. No, they need to do what they did in Vancouver there, and turn around and monitor social media and send out messages being like, hey, look, if you can identify these people, we can bring them in. Use the social media, don't fight it. You can't win.
Another thing to remember is that if, I think a year or two ago, the internet was actually declared an international human right. So if you're, that's the way a lot of people in, you know, my generation, younger and, you know, a little bit older feel, is that it's something that is used every day to communicate with people, and that it's a right to have it, and the government shutting it down is just going to piss people off more. You know, I mean, it's kind of, you know, basic, you know, if you do something like this, you're going to piss people off, and if people are already rioting, they're just going to riot more.
Oh yeah, for sure. But in more internet lockdown news, thanks to Wired for this one, and this is a similar kind of thing, cell phones blocked in San Francisco to hinder transit protest. Transit officials said Friday they blocked cell phone reception in San Francisco's train stations for 3 hours to disrupt planned demonstrations over a police shooting. Officials in the Bay Area Rapid Transit System, better known as BART, said they turned off electricity to cellular towers in four stations from 4 p.m. to 7 p.m. Thursday. The move was made after BART learned that protesters plan to use the mobile devices to coordinate a demonstration on train platforms. A civil disturbance during commute times at busy downtown San Francisco stations could lead to overcrowding and unsafe conditions for BART customers, employees, and demonstrators, BART officials said in a prepared statement. The statement noted that it's illegal to demonstrate on the platform or aboard the trains. BART said it was set aside special areas for demonstrations. American Civil Liberties Union questioned the tactic. Shutting down access to mobile phones is the wrong response to political protests, the ACLU's Rebecca Farmer said in a blog post. The Electronic Frontier Foundation said on its website, BART officials are showing themselves to be of a mind of former President of Egypt, Hosni Mubarak. Mubarak's regime cut off internet and cell phone services in the country for days earlier this year while trying to squelch protests demanding an end to the authoritarian rule, which of course didn't work. BART officials were confident that the cell phone disruptions were legal. The demonstration planned Thursday failed to develop. We had a commute that was safe and without disruption, said BART spokesman Jim Ellison. The demonstrators were protesting the July 3 shooting of Charles Blair Hill by BART police, who claimed Hill came at them with a knife. At a July 11 demonstration disrupted service during the rush hour commute, prompting the closing of BART's Civic Center station, several arrests were made.
Now, you know, as an emergency responder, I think this is an absolutely horrible idea, you know what I mean? Is what people use to communicate with, you know, 911 and report actual emergencies, you know, 90% of the time these days, it's the cell phone, you know? And everybody has them, and a lot of people don't bother to call, so the small percentage that do bother to call, they're using cell phones. What if somebody had fallen on the tracks? You know, what if somebody had gotten hurt? What if somebody had a stroke, you know? And suddenly now there's that means of communication that's suddenly gone. You know, regardless of the fact that this is a heavy-handed tactic that's absolutely ridiculous, and, you know, regardless of if it was, you know, illegal to protest there or not, you shouldn't be shutting, you know, just doing these whole blanket punishments with shutting off essential services. And that's what cell phone service really is, especially in an urban area, is it's an essential service. And even whenever, you know, as an EMT, you know, just a couple of days ago, whenever I was riding on the ambulance, what did we use to get in contact with the online medical control at the hospital? We didn't use the radio, we used a cell phone. And that's just to show, you know, just how much of a critical infrastructure this is. And this is some real fascist bullshit to be, you know, trying to shut down stuff like this. And I'm surprised that the telecom industries aren't a little more pissed off about it than they are. I haven't heard anything from the telecom industries.
Someone just said in the chat here, bets they turn off the cell phone without turning off 911. But it says here in the article that they turned off power to the actual transmitters. So if the power of the transmitters is off, that means all cell service is gone. Nothing at all. But another thing that really caught my eye in the article here is they said they had special areas set aside for demonstrations. Free speech zones where they can be easily ignored, maybe. You know, it's kind of ineffective if you go, you know, behind the barbed wire fence there and, you know, behind armed guard and then just wave your signs around for a little bit. In Space News, thanks to Maltos for this. Ring of antimatter found in Earth's orbit. The Earth has a ring of antimatter encircling it, says the Pamela Space Satellite. Says data from this Pamela Space Satellite, a multinational project aimed at studying the planet's magnetosphere. The discovery has fueled speculation that the antimatter might someday be harvested to power advanced spacecraft. The antimatter particles are antiprotons, mirror opposites of regular protons. Antimatter has similar properties to that of regular matter, just with the opposite charge and spin. The antimatter is a few hundred miles up in a ring near one of the Earth's Van Allen belts, which collects charged particles created or trapped by the planet's magnetic field. It was a challenge for the Pamela satellite to find the antiprotons in the Van Allen belt, a zone where high-energy particles are common. But the effect of antiprotons is unmistakable when it collides with normal matter, since both annihilate each other instantly, producing a measurable amount of energy and a certain charged particles. Pamela discovered a number of annihilations taking place in the Van Allen belt was about 1,000 times higher than in typical space. Now we know that there is potential jackpot of antimatter in orbit. What good is it? considering researchers spend incredible sums of money and energy created antimatter here on Earth. The idea of simply collecting it is extremely tempting. However, there are serious challenges standing in the way. Even if we could create some kind of craft or tool capable of harvesting the antiprotons in orbit, there still isn't a way to reliably contain them. The longest time that scientists have been able to contain antimatter is about 17 minutes. Still, that 17 minutes is much larger than previous times, and if the advances keep pace, it's possible technology for harvesting and containing antimatter could become available in the future. Since, in an annihilation, the entire mass of both the antimatter and the matter get converted to energy, is the most efficient fuel in the universe, and many have speculated that antimatter will eventually fuel advanced spacecraft. One of the main uses for antimatter would be a starship, scientist Michio Kaku told PC Mag in the Antimatter Universe Antimatter Discovery last fall. Because you want concentrated energy, and you don't get more concentrated than antimatter. Both NASA and DARPA have loose plans for antimatter fuel starships. With those projects a long way off, the Pamela Discovery provides a glimmer of hope that they'll someday be realized. Well, if DARPA's involved, that increases the odds significantly.
I really like the fact that DARPA's involved, you know, because one of the easiest ways to get, you know, funds is to make it related to defense. So, you know, if we can use it for defense, then, you know, we're getting funds for it. Unfortunately, NASA seems to have fallen in the wayside in the past couple of decades and doesn't really get the funding they need, and they're kind of dead in the water for the moment. But, you know, also we need to look into commercialized space flight. You know, we need to look into the commercial uses of this antimatter, and, you know, things like nuclear submarines as well as another defense application. I think that this stuff has, you know, a lot of promise, and 17 minutes is unheard of. Like, before that, they were able to capture antimatter for, like, microseconds is what it was, and now that they're able to get it into like 17 minutes, it's completely unheard of. It's an enormous advance in science.
Oh yeah, for sure. And a lot closer than getting antimatter fueled starships is if we could get enough antimatter and harvest on a regular basis, we could fuel the Earth for almost free. Like antimatter, if we could just harvest it from orbit, it would be almost zero cost versus how much energy it put out. So we could fix the energy problem in a couple decades if we could actually harness this stuff. But moving on into wet wiring news, thanks to the Doctor for this one, and it's great that Time Lords are really in on the newsreel program. Temporary tattoos fitted with electronics make flexible, ultra-thin sensors. Modern methods of measuring the body's activity, such as electroencephalography, EEG.
Electroencephalography.
Okay, thank you. Electrocardiography, ECG, and electromyography, EMG, use electrical signals to measure changes in brain, heart, and muscle activity. Unfortunately, they rely on bulky and uncomfortable electrodes that are mounted using adhesive tape and conductive gel, or even needles. Because of this, these types of measurements are limited to research and hospital settings, and typically used over a short period of time because the contacts can irritate human skin. These limitations may be at an end, however. New research published in Science describes technology that allows electrical measurements and other measurements such as temperature and strain using ultra-thin polymers with embedded circuit elements. These devices connected to the skin without adhesives are practically unnoticeable and can even be attached via temporary tattoo. All of the necessary components of the devices, including electrodes, electronic components, sensors, radio frequency communication components, and power supplies, are set with an extremely thin, about 30 micrometers, electric polyester sheet. The sheet has a low elastic modulus, that is, it's flexible, has no noticeable mass, about 0.09 grams. Now, keep in mind, 1 gram is like a paperclip. So you have a lightweight, stretchable membrane. The circuit elements, such as transistors, diodes, resistors, and sensors are constructed with typical materials like silicon and gallium arsenide, are linked using nanoribbon and micro/nanomembrane elements to allow extremely small but flexible designs. The authors refer to their approach as epidermal electronic system, EES, which is basically a fancy way of saying the device matches the physical properties of the skin, such as stiffness, and its thickness matches that of skin features, wrinkles, creases, etc. In fact, it adheres to skin using only van der Waals forces, the forces of attraction between atoms and molecules, so no adhesive material is required. Between the flexibility and the lack of adhesive, you wouldn't really notice one of these attached. One of the coolest aspects of this technology is the application method, temporary transfer tattoo, just like the ones used as a kid, where you hold the transfer sheet with a design onto your skin, then dampen it to dissolve the sheet. Here, they used a water-soluble polyvinyl alcohol, PVA, sheets in the same manner. For a power supply, initial designs used silicon photovoltaic cells to generate electricity, so solar panels. These are limited to microwatts due to the small area. Researchers also explored wireless inductive power, where an external transmission coil matches the resonance frequency of a small inductive coil in the device. Is it the same tech used in those wireless phone chargers? This opens up the door for applications that need more power than solar can provide, or for devices that work in low-light conditions, under clothing, for example. The authors also suggest that future electrical storage using capacitors or batteries. As demonstrations, authors use their devices to measure heartbeats in the chest, ECG, muscle contractions in the leg, EMG, and alpha waves through the forehead, EEG. The results were all high quality, comparing well against traditional electrode conductive gel measurements in the same locations. In addition, the devices continuously captured data for 6 hours, and the devices could be worn for a full 24 hours without any degradation or skin irritation. Very, very cool.
See, this has absolutely amazing, opportunities for stuff that could be done in emergency medicine, and this is what I kind of have experience in, so this is what kind of comes to mind with me, is instead of, having this enormous, big, ECG, and, it does all this stuff, it's essentially a big machine, it's about the size of a large toolbox, and it has all kinds of batteries and electronics, and it prints off all kinds of stuff, and it does heart rate, and it does respirations, and it does SpO2, and it does all kinds of fun stuff, and can't think of the name. the thing to shock the heart. Wow, this is embarrassing. Yeah, defibrillator. There we go, yeah. It's defibrillator, and so it's all packaged into one big... handheld unit, and it's pretty heavy. It's probably about maybe 15-20 pounds, and every time you get out of the ambulance, you got to lug that around with you. Whenever you bring it into the ER, you got to lug that around with you. And what you could do with this is you could couple this with the same technology and make flexible displays that are the same size as this, and you could literally have a live readout on someone's body. You just have it moistened with water, boom, stick it on their arm that's closest to you, and you can have a live readout of everything that you have there, just on someone's skin. That would be very, very cool. And then it would last for a long time. And you could literally transfer it with the patient as they go to the ER, because it's disposable, So you could literally just leave it on the patient instead of, bringing this with you and, lugging stuff back and forth. And it really, condenses it. And that's really, really cool.
Oh, yeah. I also think about non-medical uses for this. I mean, if they can do this temporary tattoo style, then they can make these permanent or semi-permanent, which means that you can actually, hook these up for maybe an artificial limb, so you can learn how to train it for signals and stuff like that from the brain or from surrounding muscles. You can actually use it to replace some of those computer controllers that are using EEG type activity. And you can make ones that are like skin color, just put it on semi-permanently, last a few months. And that way you have this, mind control, you're walking your house and control all your stuff. The applications for this is pretty endless. Once you get the basic, medical uses smoothed out, you can adapt it to almost anything else. In Aesthetic Police News, thanks to WPDK for this, and this is going to piss off Misanthropic to no end. Police chief confirms detaining photographers within departmental policy. Police Chief Jim McDonnell has confirmed that detaining photographers taking pictures with no aesthetic value is within Long Beach Police Department policy. McDonald spoke for a follow-up story on a June 30 incident in which Sander Roscoe Wolf, a Long Beach resident and regular contributor to the Long Beach Post, was detained by Officer Asif Khan for taking pictures of a North Long Beach refinery. If an officer sees someone taking pictures of something like a refinery, says McDonald, it is incumbent upon the officer to make contact with the individual. McDonald went on to say that whether or not the contact becomes detainment depends on the circumstances the officer encounters. McDonald says while there is no police training specific to determining whether a photographer's subject has apparent aesthetic value, officers make such judgments based on their overall training and experience, and will generally approach photographers and not engaging in regular tourist behavior. So in the same line here, they say that police have no training on this, but yet they're making judgment based on their training. The policy apparently falls under the rubric of compelling suspicious activity reports, or compiling suspicious activity reports, SAR, as outlined in the Los Angeles Police Department's Special Order No. 11, a March 2008 statement of the LAPD's policy to make every effort to accurately and appropriately gather, record, and analyze information of criminal or non-criminal nature, which could indicate activity or intentions related to either foreign or domestic terrorism. Among the non-criminal behaviors which shall be reported to the SAR are the usage of binoculars and cameras, presumably when observing a building, although this is not specified, asking about the establishment's hours of operation, taking pictures of video footage with no apparent aesthetic value, and they keep spelling aesthetic wrong here, they keep spelling E-S-T-H-E-T-I-C. You're missing an A there, guys. And taking notes. Also listed in behaviors to be documented are attempts to acquire illegal or illicit biological agent, anthrax, ricin, Ebola, smallpox, etc., in possession or utilized explosives for illegal purposes, and acquires or attempts to acquire uniforms without a legitimate cause, service personnel, government uniforms, etc. Special Order No. 11 does not distinguish between how these behaviors should be handled, e.g. photography and obtaining anthrax.
And, you know, essentially this here would make me a double criminal. Not only am I an amateur photographer, an author, a military historian, and I'm actually writing a book about abandoned nuclear missile bases in the Chicago area, but, you know, I also, again, am a military historian, and I collect uniforms. I collect, you know, uniforms from all over the world, and I have a lot of U.S. military uniforms. A lot of really interesting U.S. military uniforms, like the Guantanamo Bay Security Forces uniforms. I have two sets of those. And, essentially, these would make me a double criminal. And this is absolutely freaking wrong. This is, you know, everybody's a terrorist. Everybody's a terrorist. This is absolutely freaking ridiculous, you know? You have no right to judge what has aesthetic value or not. This is not a judgment call here. You know, what I see whenever I go photograph, you know, abandoned buildings is, you know, what most people see is trash. What most people see is shit that should be just torn down. I see history. I see, you know, I find beauty in the decay of it. And I've actually found a lot of people see the same thing that I do and do urban exploration and go into these abandoned buildings and take pictures. And to them, it's aesthetically pleasing, you know? To this guy, it might not be. So that means that now I could get thrown into the slammer because I'm taking pictures and this cop doesn't agree with me. And, you know, some cops are really cool. Some cops are freaking assholes and should not have this power to just say, oh, you're taking, you know, as a photographer, especially post 9/11, you get enough issues with trying to take photographs and stuff. And, you know, in the process of my book, I've worked with lots and lots of different, you know, I've worked with police departments, I've worked with fire departments, I've worked with city governments, you know, like parks and recreation districts. I'm currently working with the U.S. Army, and I've actually had to get, you know, offer them copies of my identification and a resume and address history and a you know, photo ID and all this stuff to get in and try and take pictures on a reserve center. You know, this isn't like any top secret place, you know, and really what I could do legally is just go from the sidewalk and take pictures. But, you know, because it's a post 9/11 environment and I'm taking pictures, you know, I don't want to be taking pictures of a military installation and have them, you know, suddenly draw down on me. The last thing I want to be doing is looking down the barrel of a goddamn gun. So, you know, as a common courtesy, I'm going through all these stupid hoops that I really shouldn't have to go through. And this is because, you know, photographers are now have now been villainized since 9/11. I mean, just look at the whole stupid thing with the light bright crap in New York. where, you know, they thought it was a goddamn bomb, and it was a freaking Moonanite from Aqua Teen Hunger Force on a light bright board, and they thought that it was a goddamn bomb. You know, seriously, the police in the U.S. these days, you know, it's not so much the cops on the ground, it's all of the freaking higher administration and the news media need to pull their heads out of their asses and stop, you know, eroding our freedoms and scaring the shit out of people for shit that they don't need to be scared of. This is just absolutely ridiculous.
As Roshan mentioned in the chat, the Moon Knight thing was in Boston, but I looked at some of the photographs this guy put on, that this guy took and got arrested for. They put some of them on the actual article, and looking at it with a trained photographer eye, these weren't snapshots, these weren't recon photos. Even if the subject matter wasn't as aesthetically pleasing to some people, the way the photo was set up was clearly supposed to be an art shot. It didn't reveal enough. It didn't have the kind of depth that someone would need to make a good layout of the area. It wasn't just a off-the-cuff snapshot. This is clearly a well-lined-up photo for the purposes of artwork. So, I mean, you're basically taking cops who don't know anything about photography and giving them a license to say what's good and what isn't and arrest people who don't have good artwork. That's ridiculous. Plus, they're also listing here, they're putting the photography along the lines of stuff like trying to acquire anthrax, which, I mean, those two things aren't related at all and shouldn't even be considered anywhere near the same severity on the terrorist scale.
You know, another thing is, in my book, what I'm doing is I'm also using aerial photography, specifically from Bing Maps. They have actual aerial photography, which is a lot better than the Google Earth. Like satellite photography. This is actual aerial photography taken from planes. And what I'm doing is I'm comparing these the shots of what they are now and the aerial photography to USGS survey photos from whenever these missile sites were actually active within the United States. And that, you know, that there's so much information available now. It's so stupid that they're villainizing photographers who just happen to be there taking photos instead of looking at satellite images from the comforts of their own home.
Oh yeah, for sure. But it's not all bad news here. There is some good news, as our next story shows, in We're Winning news, thanks again to the doctor. Aggression during G20 rally perpetuated by police, judge rules. A Toronto judge that has ruled that adrenalized police officers acted as aggressors in a peaceful political rally that led to dozens of arrests during last year's G20 summit. It's the only organized or collective physical aggression at the only organized or collective physical aggression at that location that evening was perpetuated by police each time they advanced on protesters. Justice Melvin Green ruled on Thursday. He was referring to a demonstration on Queen Street and Spadina Ave on Saturday, June 26, 2010. Green stated that police criminalized police political demonstrations, which is vital to maintain a viable democracy. Green's stern words echo widespread criticism of police during G20, in which more than 1,100 people were detained in the largest mass arrest in Canadian history. A Toronto Star/Angus Reid public opinion poll conducted on the one-year anniversary of the G20 found the majority of Torontonians, 54%, now believe police response to demonstrations during the summit was unjustified. The zealous exercise of police arrest powers in the context of political demonstration risks distorting the necessary, if delicate, balance between law enforcement concerns for public safety and order on one hand, and individual rights and freedoms on the other hand, Green wrote in a 29-page judgment. The ruling was in response to charges against one protester, Michael Putty. The London, Ontario bricklayer was on his way to a concert downtown when he joined the front line of the late-night Saturday rally. Putty was wearing a police bastard t-shirt named after a punk band when he was pushed to the ground and cuffed. And I'm skipping over a whole bunch of details here because it's kind of long. However, in the most egregious testimony of civilian misconduct at Green Street and Spadina Ave the night Putty was arrested was a single bottle being thrown, Green wrote. So the only actual protesters being violent thing they found was one bottle being thrown. This is the day after those cars were lit on fire. It wasn't the same day. Green found that the protesters were harvested by the police punch out tactic. Police would intermittently charge a crowd of about 300 people and force them west on Queen Street. and those who didn't move back fast enough were seized, thrown to the ground, and bound with plastic flex cuffs. The following day, some 300 protesters and bystanders were boxed in at the same intersection when police used the controversial crowd control technique known as kettling. Toronto police have promised to never use the tactic again after widespread criticism. Sergeant Ash Awad testified he assumed Putty had been arrested for breaching the peace when he found him bound in the wrists on Queen Street. W.O.I. found that Putty was carrying a 15-centimeter knife in a pouch on his belt. And the article goes on to explain that he was carrying the knife for work and stuff like that, and he was let off of all charges regarding the knife.
That knife is essentially a Leatherman is what it is. But, you know, this is ridiculous. You know, and one thing that a lot of people don't realize is there were actually American police deployed on Canadian soil for the G20 riots. So, or excuse me, the G20 protests, they weren't riots. But, you know, for the G20 protests, there are actually American police who have absolutely zero idea of what Canadian law allows them to do. And they were actually deployed to, you know, Canadian streets and were arresting Canadian citizens, which I think is absolutely wrong. You know, from an American standpoint, there's no reason why our police should be, you know, our taxpayer-paid police should not be up in Canada, and they should have zero law enforcement powers up there. You know, regardless, they should be absolutely, you know, just regular citizens. And of course, you know, they were deployed as police and shit like this happens. And also, you know, a lot of these guys get kind of nuts whenever there's stuff like this. And I mean, they're just as scared as the protesters are. And you have one wacko who's deciding, you know, calling the shots up high. So then you get, you know, good cops who are just following orders who end up doing shit that they wouldn't normally be doing and that they might find is wrong. And it's, you know, the whole group mentality. And you know, it's a quasi military organization, the police force. So if you don't follow orders, you're done, you know? So, unfortunately, you get one guy making bad calls, and, you know, he isn't called out on it, and you get shit like this happening.
Oh, yeah, I remember when this all happened. Several police had quit right there from being asked to do some of this stuff, and I know about at least one was fired for refusing to comply with his orders. So this is a whole big, big shit fest, and this should have never happened, and I'm really happy this judge ruled this way, because it sets a precedent that this cannot happen in this country.
Now, what I'm curious about is if that one cop that was fired, I wonder if he could possibly be getting his job back, because this was, you know, ruled as not allowing or not following an unlawful order, which, you know, in the military, that's actually something that you have to do. You're supposed to not follow an unlawful order if you know that it's unlawful. So I wonder if he might actually be able to get his job back.
I don't know. There's not much reporting on it. I mean, there's too many individual incidents that they're trying to follow that it's just impossible to keep up with it. So I don't think we'll ever find that out. In Magic Pill news, thanks to Psychros, new drug could cure nearly any viral infection. Most bacterial infections can be treated with antibiotics such as penicillin, discovered decades ago. However, such drugs are useless against viral infections, including influenza, the common cold, and deadly hemorrhagic fevers such as Ebola. Now, in a development that could transform how viral infections are treated, a team of researchers at MIT's Lincoln Laboratory have designed a drug that can identify cells that have been infected by any type of virus and kill those cells to terminate the infection. In a paper published July 27 by the journal PLOS-1, the researchers tested their drug against 15 viruses and found it was effective against all of them, including rhinovirus that caused the common cold, H1N1 influenza, a stomach virus, a polio virus, dengue fever, and several other types of hemorrhagic fever. The drug works by targeting a type of RNA produced only in cells that have been infected by viruses. In theory, it should work against all viruses, said Todd Ryder, a senior staff scientist in Lincoln Laboratory's Chemical, Biological, and Nanoscale Technologies Group, who invented the new technology. Because the technology is so broad spectrum, it could potentially be used to combat outbreaks of new viruses, such as the 2003 SARS severe acute respiratory syndrome outbreak, Ryder says. Ryder had the idea to try developing a broad spectrum antiviral therapy about 11 years ago, after inventing Canary, cellular analysis and notification of antigen risks and yields, a biosensor that can rapidly identify pathogens. If you detect a pathogenic bacterium in the environment, there's probably an antibiotic that could be used to treat someone exposed to that. But I realized there are very few treatments out there for viruses, he said. There are a handful of drugs that could combat specific viruses, such as protease inhibitors used to control HIV infection, but these are relatively few in number and susceptible to viral resistance. Ryder drew the inspiration for his therapeutic agents, dubbed DRACOs, double-stranded RNA activation caspase oligomizers, biology terms suck, from living cells, own defense systems. When viruses infect a cell, they take over its cellular machinery for their own purpose, that is, creating more copies of the virus. During this process, the viruses create long strings of double-stranded RNA, dsRNA, which is not found in human or other animal cells. As part of their natural defenses against viral infections, human cells have proteins that latch onto dsRNA, setting off cascade reactions that prevents the virus from replicating itself. However, many viruses can outsmart the system by blocking one of the steps further down the cascade. Ryder had the idea of combining a dsRNA binding protein with another protein that induces cells to undergo apoptosis, programmed cell suicide. Launched, for example, when a cell determines that it is en route to becoming cancerous. Therefore, when one end of the DRACO binds to dsRNA, it signals the other end of the DRACOs to initiate cell suicide. Combining those two elements is a great idea and a very novel approach, said Carla Kierkegaard, professor of microbiology and immunology at Stanford University. Viruses are pretty good at developing resistance to things we try against them, but in this case, it's hard to think of a simple pathway to drug resistance, she says. Each DRACO also includes a delivery tag, taken from naturally occurring proteins, that allows it to cross cell membranes and enter any human or animal cell. However, if no dsRNA is present, DRACO leaves the cell unharmed. Most of the tests reported of this study were done on human and animal cell cultures in a lab, but the researchers also tested DRACO in mice infected with H1N1 influenza virus. When the mice were treated with DRACO, they were completely cured of the infection. The tests also showed that DRACO itself is not toxic to mice. The researchers are now testing DRACO against more viruses in mice and beginning to get promising results. Ryder says he hopes to license the technology for trials in larger animals and for eventual human clinical trials.
This is really just outstanding, you know. This really heads off the whole viral evolution process where they evolve to, become drug resistant. And it really, really does, you know, get around that quite nicely. And I'm glad to see that it's having such promising results. You know, we really can't, you know just how well this would actually do, you know, in the real world, because this is all in a laboratory setting, you have to remember. So, you know, shit always goes differently in the real world. But I'd love to see, you know, 20 years down the line, I'd love to see a long survey of human trials and see exactly how that could go, because this would absolutely revolutionize the whole science of treating viruses. And this really is a huge step in the right direction.
Oh yeah, this looks like a very, very promising treatment here. And I want to keep an eye on it, because I don't want big companies, big pharma fashion companies, crushing it so they can sell more Tamiflu, which doesn't work worth shit. Anyway, in crypto-cracking news, thanks to Psychros for this. MI5, that's the British intelligence agency, called in to decrypt Ryder's BlackBerry Messenger data. The UK security service, MI5, said the government and the government communications headquarters, GCHQ, the National Communications Interception Center, have been tasked with decrypting data sent between mobile handsets of people involved in last week's rioting. The Guardian reports that the two agencies, whose anti-terrorism work is normally of a grander international scale, has been called in to help decrypt data sent across networks, including that of the BlackBerry Messenger, the encrypted messaging forum. The latter method of sending data was considered a key method of spreading details about the riots, and it is not only encrypted, but also closed to the general public, with users only able to send messages to others who already have shared their contact details. The decision to involve MI5 illustrates the gravity with which the UK government is treating the riots, and as MI5 usually focuses on issues of broader national security, while the police are tasked with the maintenance of public order. David Cameron last week told the House of Commons that his government was working with police and intelligence services to check if it would be right to block access to social networks in some circumstances.
Again, you know, this is using government resources for an absolutely wrong thing. You know, we have a lot bigger issues to deal with here than some riots, you know? Yes, it was bullshit. Yes, it was stupid. Yes, you know, I feel that the people that did do it should be prosecuted to the full extent of the law. I think that this is absolutely violating people's privacy and, you know, a lot of the, you know, basic facts of, you know, modern Western society is we shouldn't, you know, don't be evil, as Google says, you know, which they fail at miserably sometimes. But, you know, don't be evil. You know, don't be assholes with the power that you're given. You know, as they said in Spider-Man, with great power comes great responsibility. And that really is, you know, something that people need to take into account, especially if you're in the government, you know, is this doesn't affect you if you're in the government, if you're some, you know, bigwig. This doesn't affect you. But this is affecting people on the street, you know, the people that you're supposed to be, you know, sworn to protect and, you know, and help out. And you're essentially just screwing over your own people, which is a whole bunch of bullshit.
One thing that really strikes me about this is that I don't see how they're going to pinpoint which messages to decrypt without actually knowing who to go after first, because this isn't an open thing. It's peer-to-peer, basically. So, does that mean they're going to have to decrypt everyone's messages? Even those who aren't involved in the protests and the riots?
That's a good question.
So I'd really want to be careful about that, and this just shows that, of course, they might not be able to crack this, but if they are, it just shows that never trust mainstream communications methods. Always make sure that if something's really sensitive, lock it down as much as possible, or say it face-to-face. Don't put any information out over the air like that.
Use hard communications, use dead drops, you know, use things that can't be intercepted, you know what I mean? Voice, you know, face-to-face is the best, you know. You still have to worry about things like, you know, not wiretaps, but, you know, bugs and audio bugs and stuff like that, you know, laser microphones. But, you know, hard communications, you know, especially in the days of, you know, in these days of wireless communications and stuff that can be intercepted, you know, there's a lot to say for, you know, secure, you know, face-to-face or, you know, landline communications. It's a lot more difficult to find that stuff.
But that's not all here. We have more crypto-cracking news, thanks to the doctor. Researchers identify first flaws in advanced encryption standard, which makes me sad because I use this one. Researchers have found a weakness in the AES algorithm. They managed to come up with a clever new attack that can recover the secret key 4 times easier than anticipated by experts. In the last decade, many researchers have tested the security of the AES algorithm, but no flaws were found so far. In 2009, some weaknesses were identified when AES was used to encrypt data under 4 keys that are related in a way controlled by the attacker. While this attack was interesting from a mathematical point of view, the attack is not very relevant in any application scenario, because the attacker has to be involved in making the key, of course. The new attack applies to all versions of AES, even if it is not used with a single key. The attack shows that finding the key for AES is 4 times easier than previously believed. In other words, AES 128 is a lot more like AES 126. Even with a new attack, the effort to recover a key is still huge. The number of steps to find an AES 128 key is an 8 followed by 37 zeros. To put this into perspective, on a trillion machines that could each test a billion keys per second, it would take more than 2 billion years to recover an AES 128 key. Note that large corporations are believed to have millions of machines, and the current machines can only test 10 million keys per second. Because of these huge complexities, the attack has no practical applications on the security of the user data. However, it is the first significant flaw that has been found in the widely used AES algorithm and was confirmed by the designers. So this isn't really a big deal yet, but it is showing that there are some vulnerabilities in AES that we need to be aware of, and we need to keep our eyes on this to make sure that no new vulnerabilities pop up while we're still using it. Personally, AES 256, so it's a lot more secure than 128, but there you go.
Again, you know, this just shows that with any security features that you have, you know, regardless if it's encryption or whatever, there are vulnerabilities with it, and there are ways to get around it if one is properly motivated. And, you know, right now it's completely impractical to crack this, but, you know, I mean, look at how far technology has advanced in the last, you know, just even 10 years. You know, what's going to happen in the next 10 years? You know, we may be able to get past this. So, you know, everything here is fluid, and there's always ways around stuff. So, again, just, you know, keep that in mind. You know, keep that in mind with shit that you have on your computers. You know, don't keep it around if you don't need it, you know?
Got any Recomedia for us? That was last story.
Yes, I have the Recomedia here today, which is Suicide Missions, The Black Devils, which is an old History Channel documentary outlining the history of the 1st Special Service Force. The 1st Special Service Force was a joint World War II American-Canadian commando unit that was the first of its kind. It was organized in 1942 and trained at Fort William Henry Harrison near Helena, Montana in the United States. The brigade fought in the Aleutian Islands, Italy, and southern France before being disbanded in 1944. Both the modern American and Canadian Special Forces units trace their heritage to this unit. This was essentially a whole bunch of badass motherfuckers that trained hard, played hard, and generally messed things up for whoever they decided to go up against. You know, these guys were just some, you know, crazy hardcore motherfuckers. So if you want some motivation to, you know, see what you can do, you know, if you're a 36-year-old, you know, and fat neckbeard living in your parents' basement, you know, this just shows that you can actually do something with your life. All that you need to do is become a properly motivated individual. And these guys were definitely a group of properly motivated individuals. And they came from all over North America, and they even had, you know, guys from other countries that they trained to essentially be the premier commando force of the Second World War. So again, you know, it just shows that if you ever need some inspiration, look to these guys. And now for Cyberpunk Kit, we have the Everlasting Optical Disc, thanks to Wyandi. Startup to release stone-like optical disc that lasts forever. And this is, thanks to Wyandi. Startup Malentia and Hitachi LG Data Storage plan to soon release new optical disc and read-write player that will store movies, photos, or any other data forever. The data can be accessed using current DVD or Blu-ray players, which is absolutely outstanding. Malentia calls the product the M-Disc, and the company claims you can dip it in liquid nitrogen and then boiling water without harming it. It also has a U.S. Department of Defense study backing up the resiliency of its product compared to other leading optical disc competitors. Let me see if I can actually figure this out.
Millenniata.
Yeah, there you go. Millenniata. Oh, boy. And I always make fun of you for you know, not being able to pronounce stuff. That one's actually kind of difficult, though. But Millenniata CEO Scott Shumway would not disclose what material is used to produce the optical disc, referring to it only as a natural substance that is quote-unquote stone-like. Like DVDs and Blu-rays, the M-Disc platters are made up of multiple layers of material, but unlike the former, there is no reflective or dye layer. During the recording process, a laser etches pits into the substrate material. Once the mark is made, it's permanent. It can be read on any machine that can read a DVD, and it's backwards compatible, so it doesn't require a special machine to read it, just a special machine to write it. While Millenniata has partnered with Hitachi LG Data Storage for the initial launch of the M-Disc read-write player in early October, Shumway said any DVD player maker will be able to produce M-Disc machines by simply upgrading their product's firmware. Millenniata has said it has also proven that it can produce Blu-ray format discs with its technology, a product it plans to release in future iterations. For now, the platter stores the same amount of data as a DVD, 4.7 gigabytes. However, the discs will only write at 4x or 5.28 megabits per second, half the speed of today's DVD players. And you know, really, that's not a big deal, you know? That's something that could be easily sacrificed for having something that will essentially last forever, you know? And this is really great. I love this because I have an enormous freaking DVD collection and I constantly am scratching them and I just hate it. So I think this is really, really cool. And the daily hack we have today is automatically filter celebrity gossip from your TV. Matt Richardson came up with a doozy of an idea using an Arduino to monitor the closed caption on TV and mute it when news about ridiculous celebrities is on screen. He's using the video experimenter shield to monitor the captions. The shield connects via composite video and can be used to decode the binary code that carries the captions in the overscan at the top of the screen. When a keyword comes up, through an IR LED sends the mute command to the television, then waits 30 seconds have gone by since the last keyword before unmuting. And, you know, this really could be refined and used as, you know, kind of a real-life ad blocker for your television. Is it will, you know, sit there and monitor the closed captions. Commercial comes up, boom. You know, it goes all the way through the commercials on mute, 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 mute. And then it starts hitting the show again, and it unmutes. So I think, you know, that's really cool, you know. And, Like Morp says here, is you could just, you know, not watch television even. And that's what I do. I tend to watch a lot on online if I do watch any television shows, and I tend to stay with documentaries and stuff like that. But yeah, you know, this is a real good way, and there's some stuff that's a lot easier to watch on TV than it is to find online. But, you know, this is a really cool idea that could be used to essentially make a real-life ad blocker.
And that's all we have for this episode, but don't worry, we will be back next week to make sure you can get the news you need to survive. If you cannot contribute to the show, please distribute it. We would like to thank the Army of Flying Monkeys for assistance in gathering data. If you have any news stories or pertinent information you want to send us, you can reach us at news@rostudios.org. That's news@rostudios.org. If you like the music in the background, check out Industrial Lights and Magic by The Gothsicles. We fade out now with Save That Mermaid from the aforementioned album. Remember everyone, we cannot defeat the enemy if we are at each other's throats, so until next time, that's what Server said. End of line.
End of line.
Game was fucking hard!